Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about everyone who's asleep, everyone but us, the ones listening to the show, especially the conspiracy theorists in the UK who listen live and it's like 11 p.m. at night or something like that. You know, it's amazing how knowing that a huge bunch of ruthless criminals, sociopathic scumbaggery individuals are about to bust through your door and kill you and everything keeps you up at night. My very special guest is Topher Field from Topher's Unpopular View on American Freedom Radio. Welcome to the program, coming in as live from the most amazingly massive desert surrounded by alcoholics in the world called Australia. Welcome.
Absolutely. That is the most apt description of my home country that I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, it's a desert. What was it? Who was it that told me that? I think it was my mate Mike from the Zeitgeist Movement quite a few years back when we were trying to provide some counterbalance to the climate change mongers. We want a legally binding agreement. I was like, yes, legally bind us.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna take exception to your description on one small point. There's not enough of us on this continent to actually completely surround the desert. There's too much desert, not enough people. But we're working on it. We're gradually getting there. So, look, if you're an alcoholic, please come to Australia and help us surround this desert. That's the message here. That's what's coming out of this.
Australians also walk single file to hide their numbers.
It's true. We pack multiple of us onto the back of a single kangaroo just to make sure no one knows how many of us there really are. Look, this is quality listening. Quality listening. I'm glad I could have been a part of this. This will be remembered as the highlight of my career.
By the way, I'm sorry to all the Australians who might have taken offence. We're just having some fun. Have you got any New Zealand jokes to tell?
Not really. There's not really enough of you to tell jokes about. I've got plenty of sheep jokes, and I'm told that they apply.
But
there's a common misconception about New Zealand. Let me ask you this question. You'll know the answer. What's the capital of New Zealand?
Wellington.
Well, no, it's not. It's about $2.50, but it's going down every year as they lose taxpayers. Couldn't help myself.
Righto. Well, you know what was interesting? You know how we talk about a lot of shark attacks and things like that, and everybody's afraid of the Australian wildlife? Or
yep.
Dig this.
Yep.
Dude died yesterday, got eaten by a shark off the coast of, Murawai Beach. I don't have any idea why the hell anybody would swim in off Murawai. It's a horrible beach, horrible beach. Mm-hmm. And he gets killed. Three sharks come along, turn it into a feeding frenzy. The police show up, start shooting at the sharks and stuff like that to get them to shoo away. They're like, oh, we don't know if we killed one of them. Dude, if you kill a shark, it floats up, doesn't it? you know, it's just like police are so dumb.
They're not marine biologists. Let's at least cut them that much slack.
Yeah. Well, incidentally, the cop who was on the news actually reporting all of this was a cop who tried to arrest me and a couple of my mates from the Zeitgeist Movement one time when we were rolling down the road doing a Love Police sketch, you know, with a megaphone hanging out the van. Yeah. And I just like, isn't it funny how you see these familiar faces all the time? And it's always the really angry, psychotic cops that arrest you and antagonize you for no reason that always wind up getting the media coverage, but not for that reason.
Well, look, my personal interaction with cops has been rather more common than I would have liked. But so far, in Australia at least, I've actually found most of them to be very professional, very, very deceived. They believe they're doing the right things and they're completely wrong about their own perception of themselves. But I can't fault their sincerity. I hear horror stories, but my own personal experience hasn't yet gone that way. I get very frustrated because they are so resolute in their certainty of their own correctness. And I had a situation a few years ago where two police officers showed up on the front lawn of my property, of my parents' property, when my mum was home, and they were trying to throw mum out. They claimed they had a court order, and they were trying to throw mum out of the property, and mum locked herself in and called my dad, and he was hours away at the time, and I was about an hour away, and so I was sent to try and get there first and defuse this situation with the cops trying to throw my mum out of the family home. And so I got there an hour later. My mum had been on the phone with me a couple of times. She was in hysterics. She was crying. The police had told her that she was going to be arrested and thrown in jail if she didn't comply, and so on and so forth. And I walked on the property and said, let me see your warrant. And they said, well, we don't have one, but it's on its way. I said, well, until it gets here, get off my land. So they did. They walked off the land, and they started having a little bit of a go at me. They, you know, why are you arguing? Why are you giving us a hard time? You know there's a warrant out there. You know it's coming by. I said, well, look, you know, we'll talk about it when it gets here. We'll talk about it when I see it. Now, I knew that the warrant they claimed they had actually had no authority and had, in fact, expired. And so I stood my ground. I didn't let them walk back on the property. And then my dad had a brainwave. He was still a while away, but he called the cops on the cops. Because they weren't actually acting in response to a warrant. What they were acting in response to was a telephone call where someone had claimed that they owned our land and that we were the ones trespassing on it. It was a call from a real estate agent. And so he had this idea. He thought, hang on, this is an unlawful entry. This is actually, their activity is illegal. So he called the cops on the cops. And a senior sergeant showed up onto the scene who was more senior than the two people that I'd been dealing with. And he very quickly threw water all over the situation. And within a couple of minutes, I had a bit of an apology from the two constables who had been harassing my mum. And what's unfortunate, though, is that up until that moment, they were adamant that they were right. They would not for a moment believe that I might actually know more about what they were doing than they would. All they were responding to was an order that came down the line. They didn't know where that order came from. They didn't know the authority of the person who gave it in the first place or the basis that it was being acted upon. It was a telephone call. They didn't even have any way of identifying for certain the person who made the telephone call, let alone to know whether that person had the authority they claimed they had. But here were these two people on the front lawn of a family home, absolutely determined to throw a family out of their own home. And absolutely certain that they were right, that they were the good guys. And that's what concerns me about police officers. I don't have a massive issue with them at a personal level. I think a lot of them are actually very, very decent human beings. But they live in this world of certainty where that certainty is doing an enormous amount of harm. They don't know what they're doing.
It seems every other day we have an Australian on the show who's talking about the nasty Australian police at some point. It's very interesting. Anyway, back to the shark attack story, what I found very interesting is that it was the number one story in the news, right? And it was the first fatal shark attack since 1976. And they did like a full, like 4 minutes of mainstream, you know, like number one, you know. And, you know, like the third or fourth story that they covered was, hey, New Zealand's power suppliers and everything like that are going to be sold to foreigners. Next story.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's not interesting at all. There's no need for anyone to know anything about that. Why would you put that on the front page? Cynicism, people, just in case you're wondering that that wasn't serious.
It's unbelievable.
Well, you know what's happening in England at the moment, don't you, with the power stations over there, where they're looking at shutting down, don't quote me, but I believe it was 16% of their maximum capacity is being shut down either today at the end of February or it might have been at the end of March. I wasn't expecting to be talking about this, so I haven't rebriefed myself on it. But this is all part of their green energy targets. They've built all their various windmills and all that sort of stuff. And so now, supposedly, so the theory goes, they should be able to shut some power plants down, which of course doesn't work that way because when the wind stops blowing, it stops blowing and there's not much you can do about it. I read an analysis a little while ago. Some people argue that, if you have enough wind farms over a large enough area, then there'll always be the wind blowing somewhere. And so you just have to interconnect the grid and eventually you'll get enough power out of them. And I read an analysis a while ago that the entirety of the US, if you take the outputs from all of their wind farms and you do an analysis for the European Union, right across the European Union, it regularly, the wind farm generation power plants regularly fall to 5% of their capacity or below. And that's across an area the size of Europe. They still don't have wind enough on a regular basis to generate much electricity. So the whole idea that wind farms can replace baseload power generators is just moronic. However, England, being the morons that they are, my apologies to your English viewers, I am of course from convict blood, so that's my defence. If I seem a little bit disrespectful towards the old country, it's in the blood. I can't help it. But being the morons that that British politicians tend to be, they are of course just pushing ahead and closing down power plants, and I believe it might be happening today, if not in a month's time. And I believe it was 16% of their power generating capacity going offline in pursuit of a green dream.
Now, it always seems to me that there's a whole lot of really bad things that are done throughout history, which is morons carrying out the orders of assholes.
Yeah. And this comes back to the police officers earlier. I mean, they were following orders. You know, we've heard that before, unfortunately. It is no defense. I mean, you think about it. If you walk into court and you say, I was driving at 120 kilometers an hour down the highway, sir, because I was following orders – they would say, well, no, that's no excuse. Or if you say, oh, excuse me, I was ignorant of the law, I didn't know, they'll say, well, ignorance is no excuse before the law. We have no excuse. If our boss tells us to break the law and we go ahead and do it, it's no excuse for us. And yet,
can I define this? We have no excuse and they have no accountability. That's how the dynamic works.
That's exactly how it works. Because when they turn around and discover that they've broken the law, i.e. that they were trespassing on my parents' land, they, of course, just go, oh, well, really sorry about that. We'll move on.
Yeah. Hey, dig this, bro. We've got the census form like in my living room right now. I don't want to fill it out. You know, but what happens if I don't fill it out? A $500 fine plus a $20 fine for every day that I don't have it filled out. Okay.
Seriously.
And they're saying, oh, you don't have to worry about whether or not the government will use this for nefarious purposes or anything like that. It's like, motherfucker, do you know what happened? You know,
have you not read the history books?
Yeah, but there was this woman, what's her name? She's the Minister for Social Development, a rather corpulent Paula Bennett. And I think it was a while back, a couple of months ago, maybe even last year or whatever, she released the income details of a beneficiary, like told everybody how much money she was getting from her benefit because that beneficiary questioned the ethics of the Minister of Social Development. Okay. Now, that was illegal. That was secret information. Just that's not allowed to be that's not allowed to be put out. But guess what happens to Paula Bennett? Nothing.
Well, nothing, of course. No, well,
she's still the Minister of Social Development.
Yeah, she's part of the government. The rules don't apply. That, by the way, for the sake of our listeners, that's one of the easiest litmus tests to understand whether or not you're faced with any kind of tyranny. People often, when you say, oh, look, our government is turning into a tyranny, a lot of people laugh at you and go, that's ridiculous. They're not marching down the streets in jackboots or throwing people into concentration camps and gassing them. You know, you're being ridiculous. We're not under tyranny. No, the simple test of tyranny is this. Is there one rule for the government and a different rule for the people? One rule for the rulers and a different rule for the ruled. If the rules are different, you are under a tyranny. You are under a form of government that is over you, not serving you. It's as simple as that. The test is very, very easy, and I'm afraid every single Western government in the world today fails that test.
Every single one of them. You know, it doesn't matter. And I had a discussion last night with Shuri Kane, Len Horowitz, and a guy named Nigel about the Israel-Palestine conflict. And what was very interesting is that they actually enlightened me as to the scumbaggery that the Palestinians are also committing. And what occurred to me is it's like, you know what? Both sides of every major argument are usually wrong, because the only reason why there's an argument or a conflict going on is because the people who are ruling over the majority of people on both sides of the frickin' argument are scumbag liars.
Yeah. It is very interesting to me when I see various movements over there that are happening at a real grassroots level, where there are Israelis and Palestinians and conservative traditional Jews and Muslims and so forth getting together saying, hey, we actually don't want to be killing each other. And we've seen a few different online campaigns where people have taken photographs and sent them around and that sort of thing. And at a grassroots level, I don't think there's an enormous amount of animosity there. And occasionally in the mainstream media, you'll get a little bit of an insight into that when they do actually go in and they interview people. It's very much at an organizational level and at a national level in the case of the Israelis and at a cultural level in the case of the Palestinians, where they are being brought up with this culture of death to Israel. Now, there's a very, very simple test that I like to do when it comes to, I like to keep things simple. So just like my litmus test for tyranny, I like to keep a nice simple test when I'm trying to figure out the good guy and the bad guy in any given conflict. If such a thing is possible to be figured out, I like to go, okay, who needs to stop shooting in order for the shooting to stop? Simple question. The implications are very significant, though. Let's apply this to a really simple test here. Hitler is expanding and invading his way right through Europe. Let's ignore how and why the war exactly started. There's arguments about who declared war on whom and all the rest of it. Let's ignore that. Let's fast forward into the middle of the war, and Hitler is invading multiple countries and pushing his way across Europe. If the Allies turn around and go, you know what, we're going to stop shooting. No more shooting from us. We're just going to stop. Would that have stopped the shooting?
No,
it wouldn't. Because the war would have continued. The invasions would have continued. If Hitler had turned around and said, right, armies, stop shooting. War's over. Let's all go home. Would that have stopped the shooting? Yes, it would. Because the Allies simply wanted the war to stop. Now, they wanted the borders to go back to where they were pre-war. There was, you know, there's always more to it than the simplest of tests. But at a simple level, we can see very quickly and very easily that the war was being perpetuated by the continued aggression of the Germans in that particular case. Let's apply that test now to the Israel-Palestine situation. Let's have a look who needs to stop shooting in order for the shooting to stop. Well, on multiple occasions, the Israelis have stopped shooting. There's been multiple ceasefires which they have honored. And unfortunately, there have been elements within, and I'm not saying that this represents necessarily the entire Palestinian population, but there are organizations and elements within the Palestinian areas that continue shooting. They continue firing rockets, they break the ceasefires, and the death perpetuates. The only way that that particular conflict is ever going to defuse is if we have a situation where those elements within the Palestinian occupied areas actually stop firing, unfortunately. Yeah. And we see
what's happening with this situation is it's like there's two groups of extremists. There's Palestinian extremists and there's Israeli extremists. And both of them are a very, very small minority. And, the situation is thus that you can't actually solve the conflict unless people stop resorting to extremism of any kind.
Well, in particular, stop resorting to killing each other's children. I mean, that pretty much. I'm sure you heard the quote from Barack Obama. No civilized country would tolerate missiles raining down upon its citizens or something of that effect. Now, he was talking about Palestine firing rockets into Israel, but you think about his own drone attacks. What's he doing to other countries?
See, and again, there's this double standard that everybody's got everywhere. You know, the Israelis are bad, or the Palestinians are bad, or the Americans are bad, or whatever. Don't you realize, ladies and gentlemen, killing people is bad?
Yeah.
We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Topher Field in just a few minutes. Welcome back, everybody, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're rocking out here with Topher Field for 2 hours today. And we were just commenting over the break. I just love having Topher on, man. We just sit back and have a few laughs, you know. Good fun.
Can I say, before we go any further, that's the kind of music that would get me thrown in jail over here. Now, that may sound a little bit strange, so let me explain. That's the kind of music that I would play through my headphones while I'm riding my motorbike. And I would get so amped up listening to that kind of music that I would do things on the motorbike that would get me thrown in jail. I'm going to have to get the name of that band off you and see if I can track down their stuff.
Oh, that's Muse. That's a song called Knights of Sidonia.
I know Muse. I hadn't come across that particular song. Weird.
Well, when I first saw the music video for this, it's so ridiculously awesome. Like, it's the most awesome music video you could ever conceive of in your life. Nice. You know, like, I mean, look, let me just put it like this. Cowboys with laser guns.
We're not talking cowboys and aliens style here, are we? I mean, let's be honest, that wasn't a great movie.
No, we ain't talking cowboys and aliens. It was just cowboys with laser guns. It was way better.
Well, look, I'll give that a chance. I'll give that a go. It sounds a little bit interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I was just pulling up a search term for knights, and the second term that comes up is Knights of Sidonia by Muse here. So here you go. Here's here's the link, so you can probably watch that at your leisure. Right. The census. I am really concerned about this in New Zealand here because the Libertarian Party allegedly, and I should get one of them on the show. I don't know. You know what the really annoying thing is about libertarians? Because they don't give out any information. You can't freaking find one when you need one. They're calling to boycott the census and what have you. And I'm just thinking, man, the libertarian coffers in this country are probably broke enough as it is, and they're going to be busy paying all these fines and everything too.
You know what's interesting? Did I tell you last time I came on that that I refused to vote at one of our elections one time? Did I tell you about what happened there? No, well, over in Australia, we have mandatory voting. It's supposed to be one of the cornerstones of our particular version of democracy. And so whether or not you want to, you have to get out and have your name ticked off the rolls. Otherwise, they fine you. So we had a local by-election here, and I had a look at all my different options. I read through the pamphlet and saw who was on offer. And I kind of went through and went, yep, okay, communist, statist, socialist, communist, statist. I went through the whole list and just saw nothing but people I didn't want to vote for. So I thought, well, my understanding of my constitutional rights are that I have the right, in the explicit language of the Constitution, to vote as I see fit. Now, voting as I see fit must include not voting for someone I don't want to vote for. Now, another thing you need to know about the system over here is that, unlike the American system, we don't have the ability to write in a name. We can't write in the person we want to vote for. We must choose from one of the options that are put in front of us. So we have to vote, and we have to choose from one of the people that are on the ticket. And I looked at all those people and said, well, in good conscience, I can't vote for any of them. So I didn't show up. I didn't vote. And I got a letter in the mail a little while later saying that I owed the local council $55 for failing to vote in their little by-election. So I wrote them a very polite letter, quoted from the Constitution, my right to vote as I see fit, used a high court precedent that protects citizens from being required to engage in a farce, because their response would have been, oh, but you should have shown up, had your name crossed off the list, and then just done voted informal, or, you know, crossed them all out or something, done a protest vote of some sort, but you should have shown up. And that, of course, would be the definition of a farce. The definition of a farce is to participate in the form of something without actually having any influence on the reality of it. And so that would be a farce, to require me to show up and pretend to vote without having any impact on the actual vote itself. So I sent them off this letter and kind of I laid out my case that I could vote as I saw fit, and that must include withholding my vote, and that they couldn't require me to show up and not vote, which is what they would have come back with. Never heard from them again. They must have just read the letter and gone, yeah, too hard. Can't be bothered. Don't want to have to argue with this particular guy. So I don't know if something like that, you could perhaps claim privacy, or whether there's anything in your constitution or in legal precedent that would allow you not to have to disclose information. I know
that's
for example,
the difficulty because that's not my area. I don't do research. I just kind of interview researchers and stuff like that. I mean, if there's anybody listening to this particular broadcast who knows of some particular part of the statutes or anything, because you know what it's like reading legal documents and statutes and things like that, Topher. It's just waffle and crap.
Yeah,
jeez, creepers. Learn how to speak frickin' English.
Well, I do know that you have, because you're a part of the Commonwealth and your legal system has come out of English common law, you have the right to not disclose information that will expose you to a forfeiture, to a fine, to a penalty, to criminal charges. It's in a way, it's similar to pleading the Fifth in the US Bill of Rights. Obviously, the legal side of it is different, but the principle is similar, where you can't be required to divulge information that could expose you to a penalty. Now, of course, you're the only one who's really in a position to judge what information might or might not expose you to a penalty. So you might be able to argue that you're not filling out the census on the basis that the information that you provide therein may be used to charge you money, to assess your taxes, to decide various things like that.
Ironically, if I don't fill out the census, I do get a penalty imposed on me.
They've screwed you five ways to Sunday, hey? They've got you no matter what you do.
See, that's what these scumbags do, man. Yeah, I mean, no wonder people get angry. No wonder people, you know, just think, you know, if only I had an AK-47 and a rooftop.
Well, I can't say that I've ever thought that, but I know that some people do. But look, here's the thing. At some point, if we don't say enough and start to push back, and when I say push back, I mean at least in the first instance, push back in legal and political terms. I'm a great fan of the fact that Western democratic systems have relatively very little violence involved in their political systems, and frankly, I would like to keep it that way. So I don't want to see people resorting to violent means or intimidation or threats or any of that sort of stuff. So at least in the first instance, we need to actually organize ourselves and push back in a political and in a legal way. Because if we don't push back, this isn't going to stop. One of the things that really drives me, there is no bureaucrat on the planet who will ever look at the range of laws that have been written and the regulations that they've got and say, you know what, I think that's enough. I think we've written enough regulations for one lifetime. I don't think we need to write any more. That is never going to happen. In their world and in their life, more regulations are always the answer. So if we're unhappy with the amount of regulations we've already got, we're the ones who are going to have to put a stop to it. Because the bureaucrats and the politicians who are writing these regulations and creating these departments, they are never going to stop themselves. We're the ones who have to find a way, preferably non-violent, and I really stress that. It breaks my heart when I see people who waste their own life and throw away the lives of other people in some kind of a futile, bit of stupidity. But we need to organise and we need to find ways of resistance. And there's a number of ways that can be done. I mean, we've got a group here in Australia called the Australian Taxpayers Alliance, who are organising, and the more support they get, the more influence they'll start to get. And they're representing taxpayers on taxpayer related issues. And they hold a relatively speaking, fairly libertarian worldview and a fairly libertarian view of what governments should and should not do. Now, every Australian who is frustrated by what governments are doing over here should be on their mailing list at a minimum, if not donating to them. Support these guys, because these are the kinds of organizations that can actually provide us with a platform for non-violent resistance, for a non-violent pushback of some sort. There are a lot of different organizations that can be joined. There are a lot of things that can be done, even at an individual level. Educating yourself on how you can refuse to pay fines. I refused to pay a fine for not voting. Now, that's something that I learned because I have, over a period of years, have spent time reading the Constitution, reading people's analysis of the Constitution, reading the testimonies of people who have, in their own ways, done their own little pushback, who talk on radio or get online and so forth. And this is an individual responsibility. One of the comments you made earlier, which I think is very true and very funny, libertarians are often quite hard to track down because they don't tend to be putting their information all over the place. And one of the things that always amuses me is when someone comes along and says, I'm a real libertarian, I believe in individualism, blah, 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 blah. You know what? You, talking to me, should get into politics. You should start you should lead this organization, or you should do whatever. I'm like, if you're a real libertarian, wouldn't you be looking for what you can do rather than trying to tell me that I should start some organization that you can join? Isn't that the very antithesis of the libertarian sort of mentality? So I really encourage people, find a way that you can do something. Find a way that you can actually push back in some non-violent way without feeling the need to be led by someone else. Because if each of us organizes our own little thing, we're going to be unstoppable.
Yeah, and there was just something that you just reminded me of now is, what was it? Oh, yeah. If you're having a look at who to vote for and you don't see anybody you vote, then you just wish, I wish I was in the race. That way I could at least vote for myself because I know I'm not going to screw me over.
Yeah. Very, very true. I have run in one state and one federal election a number of years ago for a very, very minor party that had absolutely no chance of actually winning a seat. I was basically helping to fill the ballot and knew that I wasn't going to be elected. And that experience has really that was actually one of the things that turned me from being what would probably be termed a conservative and began the real rapid transfer for me into libertarianism. When I got a bit of a closer look at all of the other candidates, and I got a bit of a closer look at what was expected and required of me, even within this fairly conservative minor party, what their attitudes towards government were, and I began to realize, getting the right people in government is not the answer. It's getting government out of our lives that's the answer. It actually shouldn't really matter all that much who's in government, because their hands should be so strictly hogtied and they should be so limited in what they can do, and they should be so actively resisted by the population anytime they try and step outside of their boundaries that it really shouldn't matter. They shouldn't be able to screw us over. It's our own apathy that's the reason we get screwed over. It's the fact that we aren't individually and as in small groups and so forth standing up and going, no, we're drawing a line here, you can't go any further. We're actually the ones to blame.
See, and this is why I think if we actually did want to be elected, we should run for the apathy party. We'd win by a landslide.
A mate of mine actually started a Facebook group called the Apathy Party, and I could barely muster up the energy to join. So it was one of those interesting parties where if someone actually has the energy to go and sign on, then they don't really belong in the Apathy Party. It's all the people who don't sign up that obviously belong.
Maybe they should belong to the Irony Party.
Apathy and irony. Let's roll them into one.
Yeah. Like we'll form a coalition.
Yeah. The new coalition of apathy and irony parties, and as the irony party that allows you to join the apathy party because that's ironic.
Yeah, exactly. Like you have to join both parties because in order to join the apathy party, it has to be ironic. Okay. I get the dynamic.
Moving on.
Yes.
How do we get ourselves into these corners? I don't know. Anyway.
I don't know. I was explaining yesterday my theory of fractal scumbaggery. Have you heard of the fractal universe theory?
I know the fractal universe theory. I have no idea how it relates to scumbaggery, but I'm interested.
Well, fractal universe, obviously, you know, you look into one part of the universe and it starts to replicate and look exactly the same as other parts of the universe. You look into those, so on and so forth. Fractal scumbaggery is when you look into one instance of scumbaggery and you start to see that there's other instances of scumbaggery, and you look into those other instances and there's even more scumbaggery. Infinite scumbaggery up and down.
You know, the reason why I'm laughing is because that is exactly what I observed and what I came across when I started looking into the water crisis here in Australia. I think I mentioned that to you last time we talked. That's what first got me started, was the water crisis over here. And we had a very severe drought and the government was severely restricting water usage and so forth. And I began to get frustrated. I felt that they weren't doing what they should have been doing. And that was what began. That was the very first thing that got me off my lazy, apathetic backside and got me to start looking into government and looking into what they were doing. And so I began looking into – they were building a desalination plant at a cost of billions of dollars because they said that the rain wasn't going to fall anymore because we had global warming, and our now climate commissioner Tim Flannery told us that the dams were never going to fill again. So I began looking into that and began to discover that there were all sorts of alternatives, other things that we could have done that would have provided more water for less money. And then people began to call me up after I released that video and tell me about other aspects of the water issue and blah, blah, blah. And like you say, I began to see scumbaggery within scumbaggery. Well, I released three different videos, and then eventually I had to release a fourth, which I called Liars, Damn Liars, and Politicians. And that was basically about the scumbaggery. Because over the course of making the three previous videos, one about the desalination plant, one about a ridiculous pipeline that should never have been built, and a third one about a very brilliant pipeline that should be built, but of course isn't being built, by the time I'd researched those three different aspects of the water issue, I had such a backlog of scumbaggery that needed to be revealed, that needed to be put in people's faces. Now, here's a funny story, and this is an interesting little story that I think illustrates the power of the individual. I released that video a couple of months before the state election down here. And, I released that video a couple of months before the state election down here. Now, at the time we had a Labor government in power, which in this country is actually our more liberal brand of government. It's the ones who are more pro-union and pro-big government and pro-welfare programs. And we... I released that video protesting and revealing some of the lies and deception of that government. And I probably better finish the story after the ad break.
If we can remember it. We'll be right back.
I'll do my best.
Yeah. We'll be right back. Topher Field from Australia, ladies and gentlemen. You can also catch his show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Back in a minute.
Did you have to interrupt the music?
You know, I didn't have to, but I did anyway.
Oh, man. Yeah, is it pure narcissism that people like you and I like the sound of our own voices and get on the radio? Is it just pure selfishness?
There's definitely a little bit of that, but yeah. If there's an old truth who's gone, he's not with us now anymore. Mm. But he was talking about the parable of the cosmic schmuck, and he says, if you think and question, am I a cosmic schmuck? Then you are far less likely to turn into or continue to be a cosmic schmuck. But if you never question whether or not you are being a cosmic schmuck, you're definitely are one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so if you question whether or not you're narcissistic, hey, you might well be, but the mere fact that you're questioning is lessening its impact and getting rid of it.
I like it. I like it. At least if I think like that, it justifies my narcissism. I can now live comfortably with my narcissism, comfortable in the knowledge that I'm aware of my narcissism. That's nice. I like that. If I can just get back to what I was talking about just before the break, and I'll try and get through this story quickly because it's one of those ones where I can get a bit bogged down in the details. But let me introduce the players. We had a Labor government at the time, who were doing anything they possibly could to not fix the water crisis. They were building a very expensive desalination plant that was far more expensive than it needed to be and would provide far less water than some much cheaper solutions. They realized that the desalination plant would not be finished before the coming election. So what they did was they commissioned what was called the North-South Pipeline that was designed to connect irrigation districts in the north of Victoria with the suburban districts in the south of Victoria so that we could basically take away farmers' water and flush it down our toilets. The reason why they thought this was a good idea was pure politics. The pipeline could be finished before the election. Therefore, before the election, they'd be able to ease water restrictions and hopefully make people a little bit happier. It was really cynical, pure politics. Now, a woman by the name of Jan Beer started a protest group called Plug the Pipe, trying to stop the government from building this North-South pipeline, trying to show people that it was such a ridiculous idea, and it simply made no sense at any level. She got in touch with me. She gave me the details of it. I went and did my own research. I agreed with her, and so I released a video on the North-South pipeline. It was the second video that I ever did and became quite popular, all the rest of it. Anyway, fast forward a couple of months after I released that video, and I released what was my fourth video called Liars, Damn Liars and Politicians. Now, this was specifically taking aim at our, at the time, Premier and our Water Minister, who I named by name in that video. It was a name and shame video, and I brought out 10 lies that they had told regarding water. Very, very brutal, very, very honest, and very, very dangerous in this country where you can be sued for defamation even if what you've said was true. Now, they never saw fit to take me to court, fair enough, but in this country, it's always a risk, even if what you're saying is the truth. Come the election, a few months after the release of that video, the Labor Party had a surprise loss. They were expecting to regain government. They were expecting to continue in power. They lost by one seat. The one seat that they lost was the seat in which they were building that pipeline. They lost because Jan Beer, the person who started that protest group, ran for government in that seat. She only got about 12% of the votes, but she directed her preferences to the other party, to the other guys, away from the government party. And that's what cost them the seat. One person running a grassroots protest group with no money whatsoever, assisted by people like myself making videos, other grassroots people doing things at their own expense, brought down the government in a shock election loss. Brought them down over the fact that they had completely disregarded the law and completely disregarded the will of the people in the way they were handling the water crisis. So it's possible. It can be done. Now, unfortunately, the reality of our situation is that the Liberal government, which is actually confusingly our more conservative brand of politician over here, comes into power, and frankly, they're not much better. There isn't a lot of difference between our political parties over here, and I think that's a case that's true of most Western democracies at the moment.
Like you've got a choice between a left-wing fascist or a right-wing communist.
I go the other way. Fascist and communist are two very similar brands of a very similar thing, just wrapped in different packaging. It's like one's in Christmas packaging, one's in birthday packaging. That's kind of, but the present underneath is kind of exactly the same thing. In this country, I think we have a communist party known as the Greens. I think we have a hardline socialist party known as Labour. We have a soft socialist party known as the Liberals. And we have a national socialist party known as the Nationals. What we don't have is a party that isn't socialist. That's what we don't have in this country. And I think that the same thing is true of the UK. The same thing is true of the Republicans and Democrats in the US. I don't know much about the New Zealand political system, to be honest, but I suspect
they do exist. They do exist, but only in theory. Like, none of the actual, you know, non-socialist parties have ever been elected.
Yeah, and they never have enough of a – they never have much of an impact on the actual national discourse, unfortunately. So the sour note at the end of that story, the good news is she brought down the government. The bad news is it was replaced with someone who – and a form of government that really isn't that much better. And that's what we need to work on, is cornering our politicians and putting them in a position where they can't afford to continue pursuing these failed socialist policies that have gotten us into an awful mess. And the mess we're in is going to get a whole lot worse before it ever gets better. We've got to put these guys under so much political pressure that someone has to come along and go, hey, I've got this radical new idea. Let's actually make the government smaller. Let's actually, you know, reduce welfare. Let's actually start to go the other way, because going in the direction that we've been going in for the last 40 years is failing miserably. So unfortunately, there is a little bit of a sour note at the end of that story. But the good news is it is possible for grassroots individuals, grassroots movements, to be able to directly impact and affect the outcome of elections, to be able to directly affect the political process.
The proviso being is that once they have had one success, don't just go back to sleep. You actually have to keep pushing.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the Plug the Pipe group did exactly that. They went straight back to sleep. The reason being, and this is an important thing to note, they were a one-issue party. All they were concerned about was that pipeline. And once they brought to power a government that said, hey, we're not going to use that pipeline, we're not going to take water away from our irrigation districts, they said, okay, job done, all good, we can go to sleep now. What they hadn't done is actually woken up to the point where they realized that government was the problem in, you know, the broader aspects of life, not just within this pipeline issue. So that's where people like you and I hopefully come in, to light a bit of a fire under some people's backsides and actually get them started and get them awake to the point where they can't just go back to sleep.
Yeah, the old quote, I think it might have been Jefferson, you know, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance, you know, emphasis on the eternal, emphasis on the vigilance, okay? You know, you've got to be constantly fighting these scumbags. You've got to be telling your government, not asking them, but telling them what you want every single day, and do not take frickin' no for an answer. If they do, if they say no, then you go, okay, well, I'm going to have to run against you. I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to take you to court. I'm going to do, you know, it's basically like when you've got a child who is being unruly, you do not say, oh, okay, well, I'll just let you get your way, because then you wind up with a brat who controls your frickin' household.
Yeah. To quote the US government, we do not negotiate with terrorists. And I would like to add to that, even if the terrorists are in Canberra or in Wellington or wherever it may be for your particular country, I don't care where the terrorists are, I don't negotiate with them.
People don't realize that terrorism in the dictionary is a system of government, whereby the system of government where you intimidate and coerce people into doing what you want, making them afraid.
Yeah. There's a video that I really want to make, and it'd be done in the form of a short film. Oh, by the way, I don't know if I've told you, I had a short film make the finals of Tropfest here in Australia.
Congratulations.
Tropfest being the largest film festival, short film festival in the world, and 16 films out of the hundreds that are entered get picked for the finals, and one of mine was picked. And if you look up The Hustle, H-U-S-T-L-E, and The Hustle Tropfest, it should take you to the SBS page where you can actually watch that. To do a Google search for The Hustle Tropfest, and you can have a look at my most recent short film. But I'd love to make another short film, and it would be a gangster film. Set in kind of, you know, 1930s Chicago kind of stuff, where you've got the standover men walking into people's shops, you know, demanding protection money. You know, we don't want any trouble around here. You know, if you pay us this money, we'll make sure that nothing bad happens to you. Kind of thing. The standard, you know, mafia standover tactics. And develop the script and develop the story, and along it goes. And then right at the end of the story, your nasty, mean-looking Chicago. You know, Chicago gangsters turn into tax collectors and bureaucrats, and we suddenly realize that the whole story hasn't been about organized crime. It's actually been about government. Because,
you know,
think about
what's interesting, Tofu, you saying that because you know how they say great minds think alike. The other day, I was talking with my bandmate Mikhail, and he was thinking you got writer's block of a short film, and we were talking about the census, and I said, well, what if the census worker was a gang member, and he was coming over, and he had gang patches on and everything like that, and he was intimidating you and trying to get you fill out the census and things like that, and then you call the police, and then a few more gang members come over, and they're the police, and that kind of thing, and the whole mentality is that the government is the gang.
Well, that's essentially where we're at now. The things that government do, they say, right, you've earned money, congratulations, you now owe us money. That's classic protection money tactics. Oh, we see you have a business, looks like it's profitable, wouldn't want anything bad to happen.
Now, that's, with one difference, if you pay a gang protection money, you actually get protection.
there is a bit of a difference there. That's true. You've got me on that one. But it's just amazing to me that if someone comes to us with a government badge or a government title, we allow them to do things that we would never accept from someone else. You know, if a McDonald's employee, no matter how high ranking they were, walked in, knocked on your door and demanded money from you, you'd say no. But we say yes to our government. Why?
Why, indeed. We'll be right back after the break with Topher Field. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy because everybody snapped up a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. One very special guest coming at us from, you know, I think I've got that routine, you know, the fabulously Florida, blah, 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 blah. And I was just thinking about it last night. You know how 9/11 truthers are called the truth movement, or they're called truthers, yeah? I was just thinking, you know, what do you call anti-fluoride people? Toothers. The tooth movement.
I like it. I do like it. It's interesting over here. We've got a situation. I'm in Melbourne. Melbourne Metro area, and we're fluoridated. And isn't it just wonderful that our government sees fit to medicate us, whether we like it or not? I just think it's such a fantastic thing that they would serve us in such a lovely way. Not,
you know. However, usually you get bored at dinner when you go out on a fluoridate.
However, just to our south, we have the city of Geelong, and their water system is entirely separate to ours. And there was some talk a little while back of connecting the two. And I tell you what, there was a really, really healthy outcry. I really enjoyed watching it from the Geelong-based anti-fluoride people who had been saying, well, we've managed to get this far without fluoride in our water, and if we connect our water with the Melbourne system, then our water will be fluoridated according to Melbourne standards. The Geelong standards would have been adjusted to meet the Melbourne standards. And I'm actually not sure what happened in the end with that particular proposed link between the two. I don't know whether it happened or not, but certainly the fluoride argument is one that at the moment has been lost over here. But I tell you what, it's not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, I was just thinking about this the other day as well. Here's a joke for you. Why did all the government-run schools have to be shut down?
Don't know.
Because they didn't have any principals.
Oh dear, oh dear. Is that what you lie awake at night dreaming up? Just, you know, jokes that you can tell on air?
I actually do. You know, that's the scary part.
Is there a group like Internet Radio Presenters Anonymous or something that, you know, where people like you and I can go to get help?
I don't think there's anybody that can help us, bro.
You think we're too far gone?
Look, we're way too far gone.
You might be right. You might be right. So where do listeners go to if someone's listening to us going, you know what, I need like an internet radio. I mean, hey, even the network promo says that it might be addictive. So, you know, where do people go to get help? I think they should come to us to get help. You know, just keep listening to the radio show. Yeah, we'll help you. We won't help you with your addiction, but we'll help you laugh and stuff.
Yeah, we'll supply you with the more hits you need. You know, American Freedom Radio, they have an app that you can put into a syringe and just hook it to your veins.
Intravenous radio, that's genius.
Mm-hmm.
You do realize we've done it again. We're now talking utter and absolute tosh. We've managed to talk our way into it. Yeah.
A little nonsense now and then amuses even the wisest men.
Well, there you go. I'm glad you've learned that one by heart.
Yeah, it is absolutely important. In fact, I think that was a Roald Dahl quote. And people do need to recognize as well, it took me quite a while to realize this. Stuff ain't really that serious, okay? Mm. I know stuff's bad. It's really bad. But if you're not doing anything about it, it's kind of like having a boss that you really hate and a job that you really hate, and you're keeping on going in every single day, and you're accumulating this hate and hate and hate and hate, and you're not even getting it out. And so as a result, you wind up hating yourself, okay, because of your external anger. And that's what happens to a lot of people in the truth movement as well. They start to hate the New World Order, hate the government, hate the sheeple, and that kind of thing. And before you know it, you're laden with a massive carry-on baggage cult of hate, and it's not good for you, okay? You've got to let that stuff out. Like, for example, if you go out attacking people all the time and you're not actually helping anyone, you become a much, much worse and unhappy individual for other people to hang out with, and you wind up losing all your friends as well. Mm. That's why I go off and try and give people coverage, do videos for them, and whatnot. I'm not asking for anything in return. I'm mostly just really doing it for my sanity, because you maintain a hell of a lot more sanity and a hell of a lot more good humor if you're going out trying to endlessly help other people and actually succeeding.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, your way of dealing with this pressure, so to speak, I think is a good one in laughing and in finding the lighter side of it. I come at it a different way, and that is that I believe that one of the reasons why, and I've seen it happen, people who get involved in the truth of movement, for want of a better term, can actually lose their marbles, can kind of push themselves too hard. And one of the ways that I think to deal with that...
Or push the caps lock key too hard.
Exactly.
There's only three types of reptilians, you know.
And I think it's partly because of the sense of powerlessness. Human beings don't like to feel like we can't do anything, that we have no control. We want to have some sense of control. And I can't control the world, and if I could, the world would be a terrible place. I don't want to control the world. But there are elements that I can influence, and so that's what I focus on. And on my radio show, I tend to be very, very boring, very, very factual. I tend to go each week, I'll focus on either one or two different issues, and I'll break it down and I'll talk about it. And I try to finish on some kind of action point. I try to finish by saying, hey, this is something that we can actually do about this. This is something that we can actually, you know, whether it's just simply encouraging people to get active and find local people that they can support, you know, whatever that action point may be, by focusing on the things that we need to understand but are small enough that we can maybe influence them in some way, that's how I kind of maintain my sanity. And so I then produce videos and I try and influence things in some way. I just released part two of what will eventually be a three-part series. It's called the Forbidden History Trilogy. The first one was the Forbidden History of Unpopular People. That was all about free speech. I just last week released the Forbidden History of Terrible Taxes. And if you're in Australia and you've ever wondered just how much tax do you pay out of an annual median salary, well, I break it down. I actually have it right there for you. You can see exactly how much tax you end up paying once you factor in everything, not just the income tax, but also your GST, your fuel excise, and then all the indirect taxes. You know, businesses pay tax on everything that they do, and then they have to add that to the price of the products that you buy. So essentially, all business taxes are paid for by consumers. You're a consumer, you earn a wage, you pay tax on that wage, then you spend that money. You're funding taxes through the spending of that money as well. What does it all add up to? Well, this video goes into a bit of detail about that, and as is my way, at the end, it gives you some ideas about things that you might be able to do about it. And so my way of staying sane in all of this is by making these sorts of videos and trying to give people some kind of an action point, something, even no matter how small it may be, something that they can do that helps to maintain some degree of control. However small that degree may be, I think it's important for the human psyche, and I think it helps to protect against this kind of over-analysis paralysis that some people get.
Yeah, and the worst thing you can do is nothing. I think I was listening to your show. I caught the tail end of it. It might have been Let me see. I've got the date down here on the 1st of February,
right.
And you were doing this rant about the new rights industry in Australia,
yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, that was the most fantastic rant that I've heard in at least 3 or 4 years. You know.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. No, look,
I've heard a lot.
Yeah. Well, and before I actually sort of wound up in my sort of concluding points, which is probably what you're referring to as a rant, I had spent the previous hour or so really breaking down what rights are, positive rights versus negative rights, trying to give people a really good understanding. And I guess that's more my particular angle. I try and help people to understand something and then be able to do something about it. And in particular, one of my great joys is when people get in touch with me and say, you know, things along the lines of, hey, thanks to your show, I was able to have a conversation with, you know, another person XYZ, and explain things to them. And if I've empowered other people to be able to explain, because a lot of people agree with a lot of what the things that you and I say on air, but a lot of people don't feel that they're empowered to enunciate it, to be able to explain it, to be able to convince somebody else. And if I can bring someone to the point where they can have a conversation over the lunchroom table or over the dinner table or wherever it might be, and actually be able to enunciate these ideas and explain the things that they believe when it comes to government and libertarianism and so forth, then I've achieved my purpose. And I tell you, they are my absolute favorite types of emails to get from listeners and from fans, is people saying, hey, listen, thanks for that video. I sent it on to a friend and now we're, you know, he's open to these ideas now when he wasn't before. Or, you know, I took what you talked about on radio and I talked about it with my wife or my husband and yeah, and so on. They're absolutely my favorite kind of emails to get.
It's so positive, you know, because you're actually waking people up. And I was looking at this Facebook group just earlier while we were on off air, I think, and it says "Wake up the masses," and I went, "What a stupid idea!" I don't need to mean to sound like angry or bitter or silly when I say this, but you know, just look at the reality, ladies and gentlemen. What Topher was saying before is about how one group of grassroots people with zero budget managed to actually affect the election outcome on a very poignant issue. The masses did not really participate. Okay, all of history is basically the good guys and the bad guys duking it out against each other. One is trying to control the masses, and the other is trying to give them freedom to the people who refuse to fight for it themselves. Okay, the masses don't matter; they have never mattered, and it doesn't mean that I hate them or I don't want to think. I want them to be free because they're the ones who raise good children. They're the ones who actually do good, decent, hard work. They're the ones who grow all the food. They're the ones who do all of these things that actually make our society work. That's the masses' job. It's the job of those who are of a higher calling to lead those masses to freedom, not to wake them up to the other scenario. Because it's just not possible.
Well, look, I don't.
Well,
think
I'm not sure if it's not possible, but it certainly has never been done. And not to mention, in order to free everybody, it doesn't even need to be done because it's been done before.
Allow me to disagree with you on one point, though. I still think it's important to try. And the reason for that is this. It's not your or my place to decide who's who. That's a very communist idea. Oh, well, I'll organize society. You're one of the elite. You're one of the smart people. Oh, you're just one of the masses. We'll just send you off to a farm to work kind of idea. So I think it's important to try to just get the message out. Some people will respond. A lot of people won't. But let people make up their own minds as to where they fit in the scheme of things rather than trying to, you know. Yeah. But look, can I
also make another point as well? The communistic ideal of we need to have collectivism and things like that, I think is also the reason why people want to wake up the masses, because it's almost like I want to wake up the masses because I don't want to have to do anything myself. I want everybody else to do my job. And that seems very collectivist and communist to me too.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a complex thing.
I'm sure you would have come across those. It's like a poem sort of thing that's been written about somebody, nobody, anybody. I think it's just those three. And, somebody wanted anybody to do something, but, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it sort of treats them as people. And it just really points out this whole thing of we're all waiting for each other. You know, we're all somebodies, we're all anybodies, we're all nobodies if we want to be, you know, if we choose to do nothing. But we're all actually out here waiting for each other. And if we really believe that individualism is the answer, if we really believe that we don't need to be organized by some central organization, by some central bureaucracy, then stop waiting for a libertarian movement to come along for you to get swept up in. Because what you're asking for is inherently anti-libertarian. A libertarian movement, which is actually forming, must, by definition, be made up of the individual efforts of a whole bunch of people acting independently, whose cumulative effect becomes a movement. It cannot be following a particular person. It cannot be, oh, well, there's a libertarian political party. Yes, we need libertarian political parties. But if they are leading the charge, we've got a problem. Because libertarianism, by definition, requires individual action and individual responsibility. That's why I push so hard, and I push my listeners, and I'm now going to push your listeners so hard. Just do something. Find that one thing that really rings your bell, that one thing that really gets your goat, and do something about it. Because it's that cumulative effort of all of us doing those little things that then add up to a movement.
I have described it as the tactic of the cactus. A cactus protects itself by covering itself in spines from every direction. And for every conspiracy, there is one activist in one particular area or town or whatever for whom that conspiracy is their absolute bee's
That's
knees.
The most
you know,
it's
their
yep.
passion. And, yep. you know, without even noticing that there's other spines on this cactus, you wind up arbitrarily and acting in a collectivist fashion to protect it without even being aware of any of the other spines of the cactus protecting humanity from tyranny that's coming to get you, and you give them a little prick.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's each of us. I mean, you know, if we can all be little pricks, I think that's the takeout here. if I can put it in crass terms.
I'm 6'4". It might be a bit difficult.
Well, you can be a big prick then. You have my permission. No, but
you see, that's more my style.
Yeah, no, fair enough. We've got to get away from this idea. And I get asked this. I get asked by people all the time, would you run for government? The answer is no, people. Number one, I don't want to throw away my life by getting caught up in the political machine. I have better things to do. I really do. You know, I have much more enjoyable things to do than getting trapped in politics. Secondly, you shouldn't need me or you, Vinny, or anyone else, particular person. It shouldn't have, you know, the attempt to get Ron Paul in as president was fantastic. I certainly supported the idea, but it was missing the point. A lot of people felt that when they failed to get Ron Paul in, that was it. Oh, well, it's over. No, it's not. It's about what each of us individually do. It's not about those centerpieces. It's not about those high-profile individuals that we can all, you know, get in line and follow. That's missing the point. It's about what each of us can do individually. Now, if Ron Paul had gotten in as president, let's say by some miracle he'd been nominated by the Republicans and then had won the election, you know, in 4 or 8 years' time, he would not have been the president anymore. And without overwhelming support from the American people and from the Senate and from the House, he would not, in that amount of time, have been able to shape or reshape America into some libertarian paradise. It's something as big and as complex as an entire nation takes more time than that to change the direction of. It takes more time than that to reset, if you will, back to its founding principles. What that means is that even if Ron Paul had become president in some perfect world scenario, we still would have needed individuals to stand up and take their own individual action in order to reshape the country back into libertarian ideals, back into its founding ideals. It does not matter who you think you're following. It does not matter who you think can save the day for the libertarian movement. The bottom line is, it's up to individuals.
Well, and again, it's like G.E.W. Griffin told me, he says, there's no such thing as a group. It's an abstraction. Kind of like there's no such thing as a forest. You know, you can't touch a forest. You can't touch a group of people. You can touch a tree. You can touch a person. All there is the individual. Really. If you're trying to make the world into a collectivist model, you're trying to make the world into something that does not exist. And that's called insanity. We'll be right back.
Got nowhere to run to, baby. Nowhere to hide.
Welcome back. It's not drones that I'm running from. It's the earthquake weapons I know will come. Look, you listen to the video.
I preferred their version. No offense, but their version.
Well, they're singing about love. I'm talking about devastation and death and like the Rockefeller Horror Picture Show or something, whatever.
Death, destruction, murder, madness, and mayhem. One of my favorite subjects.
In fact, there's even a DJ duo. One's called Mischief and one's called Mayhem, and they do sets together.
Mm.
That's
kind of clever. Yeah, I like that. I like that.
Welcome to the stage, Mischief and Mayhem.
Yeah, I'd go see that. I'd pay money to see that.
Yeah, if we had any.
Look, I don't even bother to say that anymore because it's just an assumed, an assumed addition to any statements that I make. If I had money, I would ...
Yeah, that's funny, isn't it? Have you noticed how everybody in the truth movement, bar maybe a few people, they're just broke-ass mofos, they got nothing. And what's interesting is that you have a look at all these people in the mainstream media who shill BS for a frickin' living. They're rich as hell.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. One of the things that I've noticed is that wealthier people tend to have more invested in the system and tend to be more resistant to the idea that the system may be flawed in some way. If someone's made a lot of money in business or in banking or in finance, they don't want to hear that our money is fictional. They don't want to hear that the fractional reserve banking system is a con, that the US Fed is one of the greatest frauds ever perpetrated, because they've made a fortune out of this line of work. I had an interesting conversation a little while ago with a guy who works in debt collection. Now, the company that he works for buys debts off banks and so forth and then rings people and sort of threatens them with legal action or the rest and tries to get money off them. And I said, you do realize that debt can't be assigned. He said, ridiculous. We get these things enforced in court all the time. I said, well, I know you get them enforced in court, but if someone knows their defense, if someone knows what they're actually talking about, you'll be thrown out on your ear because it breaches the privity of contract. Contracts can only be applicable to the people who signed them in the first place. Even if there is a clause in a contract saying that it's assignable, it cannot be assigned to a party that was not privy to it in the first place. And if you walk into court with that defense, it will get thrown out. Now, I had a dispute a while ago with a company that were claiming that I owed them money that I don't believe I owed them, so I refused to pay them. They sold the debt onto some poor unsuspecting collections agency, and that collections agency then rang me. And I said, well, excuse me, who are you? And they went through the whole usual rigmarole of, oh, well, we bought the debt, it's now been assigned to us. I said, well, that's fantastic. You've got a contract with that company. You go and chase that company. You don't have a contract with me. And evidently, they went and got legal advice and found out that I was right because they stopped chasing me. They didn't bother to actually pursue that any further. Now, some people get dragged into court and have to use the defense in court. Some people present that defense to the companies that are chasing them, and the companies know enough to walk away. My point here is that these are people who have something invested in the idea that the system is okay. These are companies who depend on the ignorance of the rest of us in order to be able to continue perpetrating their particular business model, which is to intimidate people into paying money, which they're actually not legally obliged to pay because of the assignment of the debt, which is not legally enforceable, as much as it will be enforced by a magistrate if you don't come in with the correct defense. It's actually not legally enforceable. So there we have an example of a business that has a vested interest in believing that the system is good, that the system should continue as it is. And I tend to find that the more people have made money, it tends to be the big one, the more power people have, the less open they are to the idea that things are not the way they ought to be.
This reminds me of a conversation my uncle had with me. He was really, really drunk and scabbing a cigarette off me while telling me that because I have smoked weed, I'll never amount to anything.
That makes perfect sense.
And he's very wealthy and has made an awful lot of cash out of getting people in debt to buy his cars and things like that. He's got his own financier operation and what have you. It's exactly what you're talking about. And meanwhile, it doesn't matter to him that I've become the top-ranking conspiracy commentator in New Zealand history, or that I've put more New Zealand activists on air than anybody else in this country's history, or that I've met and rubbed shoulders with the top commentators in hundreds of different fields and whatnot. It doesn't matter to him.
No. The scorecard, as far as a lot of people are concerned, is your bank account. That's the scorecard. And unfortunately, what they sort of fail to realize is that when you die, which we all do, we all will, that scorecard is actually the most worthless. The scorecard that matters is the mark that you've left on other people's lives. It's actually the influence that you've had on other people's lives and whether or not you've made the world a better place and other people's lives better to live. But unfortunately, for these sorts of people, they have money and that proves that they're right.
Yeah, yeah. It's a measure of success at life, and that's the parameter that they've been brought up to. You're only successful at life if you achieve this achievement. If you don't achieve that achievement, you haven't achieved anything.
It's an interesting one because for some people, that's education. The proof at success at life is having a doctorate, or at the very least having a master's, you know, with an honours year and what have you. You know, for others, it's money. Proof at success of life is money. It's interesting. So much of our world and so many people are completely consumed by pursuing ideas of success that die when they do. Have a think about all the common pursuits: fame, fortune, education, power. These pursuits all die when we do, which means that ultimately they're all actually worthless. We can't carry power with us into the grave. I mean, things that we wrote might be influential and so forth. We might be able to influence others. But in terms of actual active power, the ability to make something happen, it dies when we do. You know, our money becomes worthless to us when we die. None of that's actually worth anything. And yet so many people who don't question the system around us are pursuing the very things that they can't take with them when they die. Their entire life is invested in pursuing what in the end turns out to be a lie.
And then there are those people who will write in their will a whole bunch of insane requests and things like that. This is what you want to do with my money, and I want to make sure that person over there doesn't get any of it, and I want to finance this, that, and the other, and this kind of thing. It's a really selfish thing to try and fulfill your deeds beyond the grave. This is what my father did to my family after his death and everything. I didn't know until after he died that I was disowned at the age of 11. You know, isn't that interesting?
Wow.
And I didn't know until 17 years later when he died that me and all my brothers and sisters ain't getting nothing out of his umpteen million dollars of whatever.
Yeah, that's lovely. Nice thing to find out.
See, and this is exactly what we're talking about here, about the measurement of success in life and how unwilling you are to really change your views on it, you know?
Mm. Well, here's the interesting thing. Money is important because it empowers you. It makes it easier for you to do things. What you choose to do is what really matters in the long run. Having money certainly makes it easier. And so, for example, I'm trying to work my way into the film industry, and part of that is to be able to influence the sorts of ideologies that are getting put forward in films and in television, that sort of stuff, because I think a tremendous amount of influence is exerted by our entertainment media. But part of that also is in the hope that I'll be able to make a bit of money and be able to get on with doing some of the things that I think are really going to be important. People with a bit of money, you know, funding certain public awareness campaigns, financing certain kinds of court cases against governments and government agencies, and these sorts of things that I want to do that unfortunately do require money. So it would be silly for me to sit here and say that money's not important. But if someone is prioritizing money to the point that they believe it's a scorecard, that the having of the money itself is actually the purpose, then unfortunately they've condemned themselves to living a completely pointless life. They're pursuing a measure of success that is just worthless.
Well, see, and again, it's like sort of vengeance, wanting to get revenge on people, things like that, you know. The word RE, or, you know, repeat, revenge, regurgitate, you know, that kind of thing. If you really kind of operating under any type of paradigm that starts with one of those RE words, you're not actually going forward, you're going backwards. You're repeating things rather than actually creating and moving things to a better place. And I've got this conclusion as well that if you're not focused on pushing things forward, if you're not focused on progress, then you are most certainly focused on holding yourself and everybody else back with you.
That's a tragic reality where people just lose their entire lives trying to set right something that happened in the past. There's this funny thing about the past. You can't change it. That's what makes it the past. It's already passed you by. It's happened, and nothing, you know, nothing that you do is ever going to change that. You know, for example, if I can touch on something that's close to home for you, your father disowned you from the will. Unfortunately, that's past. You know, and yeah, you've obviously just gotten on with trying to have your own life and trying to have your own influence, and as you say, move forward. What you know, you've asked yourself the only question that matters, which is, what can I do? And this goes right back to what we were saying before about just that individual action. So many people email me or ring me or talk to me and say, but what can I do? You know, this, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't do the other thing. Okay, what can you do? You know, I've had people say to me, oh, but I'm not articulate. I could never host a radio show. Well, if everyone hosted a radio show, who would be listening to you and me right now, Vince? Mm-hmm. You and I would have a very boring, very pointless little chat right now.
It'd just be you and me having a conversation.
Yeah, it's called a Skype phone call. You know, lots of people do that. There's nothing particularly unique about it. And so the point isn't to mimic what someone else is doing. The point is to stop saying, oh, I can't do the things that those guys are doing, or that woman over there is doing, or that he's done over there, or whatever it may be, and say, no. In my life, in my world, in my neighborhood, in the things that grab my attention, what can I do? And if more people ask themselves that question and then actually took action, no matter how small and insignificant that thing might appear to be, just start. Just take action. Start to do things. And then all of a sudden, a movement comes out of nowhere, a genuine grassroots movement, a genuine movement that is motivated by individuals who each took the little step, the little thing that they could do, and all of a sudden it adds up to be a massive thing.
You know, this also reminds me of an incident. I was walking down Queen Street in Auckland one day, and I saw this kid holding an empty box, and he had a black eye. And I went up to him and I said, bro, what happened? And he says, oh, my dad's the owner of Dickie's Work Clothing in New Zealand, and he gave me a whole box of clothing to, you know, just kind of give out to people free on the street. And a couple of guys came up to me, bashed me over and stole all the clothes out of the box. And they stole my weed too. And I was like, bro, that is freaking sad. And I had a joint in my pocket. And this guy had also had his cash taken off him, and I had a joint in my pocket and $10, and I gave it to him.
Mm.
So it didn't matter right then at that moment that he'd seen the worst of humanity, because the best of humanity was there to just come and straight pick him up. Okay, that's the small difference that you can make. You know, it doesn't matter how many bad things happen to you. It only takes one good thing happening to you to make all of that go away if you're willing to be open to it.
And it's funny how that good thing can be disproportionately small compared to the bad things. You know, how many times we've all faced in our life some absolutely heartbreaking moment, something that's just awful. And all it sometimes takes is for one person to come along with an encouraging word. And an encouraging word is nothing in the face of whatever it is that's gone wrong, and yet somehow it makes all the difference. You know, a lot of people look at the world and they see how much is going wrong, and they say, well, I can't compete with that. I can't match the scope and the scale of what's awful in the world and what's going wrong. Well, the good news is you don't have to. You've just got to come along with what little you've got to offer. It's, you know, if I can go to a religious reference, you know, when Jesus was giving his sermon to the 5,000, we have it recorded that no one had brought food with them. No one obviously expected him to talk for as long as he did, and they all got hungry. And so Jesus takes the 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and he multiplied that. Now, what's interesting is that boy didn't come along to feed everyone. He came along to feed himself, but he was willing to offer that little tiny bit, which was totally inadequate. It was completely inadequate to the task at hand. And yet, you know, in that case, through the power of God, it was multiplied. And I think that there's a very real sense in which that happens when we do good things for each other. There is this multiplication effect where we come along with what little we have to offer, however inadequate that may be to the task. But when we offer it, when we actually just put it out there and say, here's this little one good thing that I can do for you, there is a sense that it gets multiplied. It becomes far more powerful than that little thing should have any right to be, and yet it makes a massive difference.
Mm-hmm. And another incident that also comes to mind as you were saying that is I did these filming dance parties, these shift parties back in the day, right? And we had these after parties, and one person turned up to the after party sort of late, and she'd been pulled over and given a $60 ticket for speeding on her way to this party that she was late for. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, "Oh man, that sucks. Here's $5." And then before she knew it, she'd been given $80 from all the people surrounding and the thing. And it's like, wow, that's amazing. That's so cool. That's so wonderful. Yeah. And everybody loves me. And it's almost like, I thank God I got that ticket, because if I hadn't been given that ticket, I wouldn't have been given so much support and realized my faith in all these people around me was well placed.
Yeah. And that, I think, would be a significant thing in that story. It's not about the money. It's about the fact that she felt loved. She felt that support. It's not about the fact that, oh, hey, I've just turned a profit by speeding. You know, I turned a $60 fine into an $80 income. You know, no, it would have been just the fact that she suddenly discovers that a room full of people that were just people a moment ago are now actually, you know, friends, are actually supporters and people that actually love her in that way. So, yeah, it's the little things. It really is the little things. You know, where I live in Melbourne, there are a lot of homeless people around, and it can really wear on you. But at the same time, you know, it takes something very, very little, very, very small to completely change their day.
That's right. And ladies and gentlemen, understand, even though evil is around you, it's the little good things that you do every day that keeps the badness at bay. We'll be right back with Topher Field at livingusefulshow.com. Welcome back. Jamming we are, a big monkey wrench into the apparatus of brainwashing and New World Order scumbaggery. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. By the way, my girlfriend, you know how Topher, when you take your car in for a warrant check and you kind of like cross your fingers, let's hope nothing's broken.
I'm assuming that's a roadworthy type check in New Zealand. Is it a warrant check? Okay. Yeah.
I don't think she had her fingers crossed. $1,400, and there's nothing actually really wrong with the car. It's just wear and tear, you know, like brake pads, tires, this sort of stuff. And we don't know what the hell we're going to do. And I told her I'd ask the listeners. I mean, look, it's when you've got a missus. Her financial problems are your financial problems. So, and when you have listeners, my financial problems are something you can help with. So please, if you can donate 1,400 New Zealand dollars, please do. Go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Go to and click that big old-fashioned donate button, and we'll get the Mrs. Car fix, because she's quitting her job. I've been telling her for years, you know, honey, you got to quit that slave job. You've got to stop, you know, being part of the system. You got to work for yourself. And she's finally decided to. And of course, once she finally decides to quit her slave job and her solid source of income, boom, $1,400 car repair bill. The universe is a
right
funny
there.
Place, isn't it? It's like, is this place fracking with me?
Well, I'll put in a good word for you here, in that it takes an awful lot of commitment to do what you do, and you're on 5 days a week, and you're on for, you know, a couple of hours at a time, and that pretty much precludes you and denies you the opportunity to hold down a normal job. So I'd certainly throw in a good word for you and say, look, you're doing good work, and if there is anyone out there who can help you to fund yourself. Because let's be honest, the mechanic and the government doesn't care whether or not you have an income. They just want you to pay up and be done with it. So if there's anyone out there that can help, then certainly please do.
Also another side of things is that I've been really concerned recently that there's so many bloggers and activists and filmmakers and radio show hosts out there which is totally broke. But that's on the one hand. On the other hand, whenever they need a bill paid, whenever they need something sussed, it gets sorted. But usually right on the deadline. Like it'll come in exactly when you need it.
And as only result, as much as you need. Yeah.
Yeah, and only as much as you need. And as a result, two things happen. You learn not to stress about things that are in the future. You only stress about things that are right in front of you right here, right now. Mm-hmm. And number two, you have faith that everything's going to work out in the end.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a funny old world, because I've been threatened with being thrown in jail over different things where I've refused to pay the government here various fees and charges that they've wanted to charge me for their services, which I never asked for, and things that I never wanted them to do. And I don't know, I got to the point, and I don't know, if I was faced with it again, I'd probably have to re-get to the point, to the same point again. But I got to the point where I was like, you know what? If I go to jail, it'd be absolutely awful. I would hate it. I mean, jail is not going to be a fun place for me, but that's cool. You know, that's okay. If they throw me in prison because I continue to refuse to pay the extortion money which they're demanding from me for no good reason, I'm actually willing to go to jail rather than pay them that money. And you kind of get to this place where you mentioned faith. It's, for me, it's very much a case of just having the faith that no matter how bad things get, it's still okay. It's, you know, okay, so I don't have money to pay that bill. I'm getting people, you know, I'm getting telephone calls from people telling me that my bills are overdue. I'm getting various things like that. That's actually okay. I'm actually able to sleep at night under circumstances that other people might sit there and think, oh, no, you know, this is terrible. This is impossible. This is, you know, this can't be happening to me. And I just sort of go, okay, I'll worry about that in the morning. You know, there's nothing I can do right now. It's whatever time of night it might be. And it's just okay. Close my eyes, go to sleep like a baby. You know, the greatest peace can sometimes come in the worst of circumstances. It's more a state of mind. It's just a way of being and a way of living.
Yeah,
that brings peace.
This reminds me of a conversation I was having with my mate Mikhail. We were sitting in the car, and he just learned about the reptilian conspiracy and the aliens and all that kind of stuff, and he's just kind of freaking out about it. And it's like, oh my god, there's reptilians in charge of everything. And I said, okay, bro, even if they do exist, let me ask you this question: have you ever seen one? No.
Yeah.
Have one of them ever actually done anything to you that you can really quantify? No.
No.
Then you're sitting here being afraid of something that you've never seen and has never actually done anything to you that you can quantify. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, that's an interesting realization, Vinny. I'm suddenly not afraid anymore.
And that comes right back to what I was talking about before about control. I like to focus on the things that we can exert some level of control over. And the rest of it, if you can't control it, why in the world would you lose sleep over it? Honestly, why would you sit there stressing about something that you cannot control? You know, if you are sitting there afraid that the government is going to come and bash down your front door, let me ask you something. Can you control whether or not they show up tomorrow morning to bash down your front door? No.
I can. Two words. Bear traps.
Well, what I was about to say, all you can do is be prepared or not be prepared. So if you've taken the reasonable steps necessary to be prepared for such an eventuality, don't lose sleep over it, because you cannot control it. You cannot control whether or not they show up. All you can control is whether or not you're prepared. If you're prepared, go to sleep. Sleep like a baby. You know, enjoy a glass of wine. You know, talk with your wife and your husband and your family and live a normal life. Don't sit there paranoid over things you can't control. Take control over the things that you can control and then leave the rest.
Yeah, the rest is inconsequential. I mean, you know, what difference does it make? Well, here's the difference that it makes. You lose sleep, which has adverse effects on your health and mental stability. And if you ain't healthy and you ain't mentally stable and you're wanting to contribute something good to society, you're not going to be able to, because you're stressed about things you can't do nothing about and making yourself unwell in the body and in the mind.
And the antidote to that, of course, is listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show and having a good laugh every day.
Uh-huh.
Just a little shameless plug in there for you, Vinnie. I'll send you the bill later.
All right.
No worries. Now, speaking of shameless plugs, I just realized during the break that I mentioned my latest video and didn't give a URL where people can go and actually have a look at my work and see some of the stuff. So if you don't mind, I'm going to jump in. And if you'd like to have a look at the two existing parts of what will become a three-part trilogy called the Forbidden History Trilogy, you can go to www.theforbiddenhistory.com. cryptic. I know you wouldn't expect that for a series called Forbidden History, but it's www.theforbiddenhistory.com. And parts one and two are already up. Part one is all about free speech and dealing in particular with the Finkelstein Report, which is an anti-free speech report that came out that was a recommendation to our government here in Australia, although it deals with wider issues of free speech and should be of interest to people around the world. Then part two, which has only just been released a week ago, it's already got over 20,000 views, is all about taxation here in Australia. And if you want to get some idea of how much tax a median wage earner actually pays over here, then I break down all the figures and go into detail about what happens to our tax money and so forth in part two, The Forbidden History of Terrible Taxes. So www.theforbiddenhistory.com, and check it out, pass it on, and the more support you can give me and the more you can spread those videos far and wide, the better it's going to be for me, and in the end, hopefully, if my videos are able to influence people, the better it'll be for everyone.
Right. Well, we only have about 2 minutes left in the show now. What exactly are we going to do in the next couple of weeks? I mean, I have this real concern, of course, that you know, there's a census going on, and the New Zealand assets are being sold, and there's drone strikes and the NDAA and this kind of thing. And like we were just pointing out earlier, these things are outside of our control. So it's not something we can really do a whole lot about. I don't know exactly where I'm even going with this. To tell you the truth, there's a whole lot of stuff going down every single day, but you don't really have to deal with it if it ain't your responsibility. What's going on in America ain't my responsibility. Sure, I have an American talk show, and I bring on Americans to talk about these kind of issues so that the public who are listening can actually do something about it. If you're listening to this show, by all means, don't let us take the responsibility off your hands. Please don't.
The key takeaway here is, please do what you can. Vinny, you're on this, you're hosting this radio show because that's something that you can do. I make my videos and I host my own radio show because that's something that I can do. Jan B, who I mentioned before, she started a protest party against a pipeline that was being built because that was something that she could do. The focus has to be, listeners, what can you do? What's that one thing, big or small, that you can do that'll begin to make a difference?
You know, it's really that simple, isn't it? Mm. A friend of mine, he was like virtually in tears at a bar a couple of weeks ago, because he's doing the thing you shouldn't do. Think about all these things that are outside your control. And he was like, what can I do? What can I do? As though it's a rhetorical question. And look at it this way, ladies and gentlemen. Don't think what can I do is a rhetorical question. It is a question that requires an answer. But more to the point, it is a question that requires action. Mm-hmm. Don't sit back and do nothing. Do anything, you know. Just like me, given my last joint, my last $10 to a guy who'd been knocked over and had all his stuff stolen off him. Just one tiny little action like that, in any way, shape, or form that you can do any day. Go out there and freaking help somebody who needs your help. Just in some small way, you will feel better about it because you know that you're actually doing something worthwhile and good with your life and good for people. If you want to spend all your life, on the other hand, attacking people of any kind, regardless of whether or not they're bad guys or good guys or whatever the heck that you think that you're doing, just remember that if you're going to attack people all the time, you will run out of friends very, very quickly, and you'll have nobody to defend you when people come to attack you back. Topher, thank you so much for your time, man. It's been an incredible show. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.